Welcome to the Fly Culture Podcast, bringing you interviews, reviews, and fishing tips. Here's your host, Pete Tigus.
Welcome back to the Fly Culture Podcast, everybody. We're still in lockdown at the time of recording. It's early April. If you've tied all the flies you can tie, read all the fishing books you can read, and need a little fishing fix, I hope this podcast will go some small way to taking you to the water. Today, I'm pleased to be joined by Matt Easton, who is an extremely talented angler, blogger, contributor to fly fishing magazines, including the very latest edition of Fly Culture. I'm pleased to be talking to him a little bit about his history of fishing, learn a little bit of about the fishing that he does in his part of the world. So Matt, it's great to have you on board.
Hi Pete, it's an absolute honour to be considered for Fly Culture Podcast. I'm a big admirer.
Well, that's so kind of you to say, and it's been lovely to talk to you. I know we've been talking recently as well and via the magazine and everything else, and I know you were a great supporter as well of Eat Sleep Fish when we did that, so thank you so much for that. And it's just been, you know, as one of the people when the internet sort of really started to get going with your blog and everything else, which we'll come on to, I've just always been a fan of everything you've been doing up in that neck of the woods, and it would be really nice to learn a little bit more about the fishing that you're doing. But how are you doing at the moment? Have you managed to get out? Did you get some fishing done before we got locked down?
I got one day, opening day around my neck of the woods is the 15th of March, and which was a Sunday, and myself and my good friend Stuart Minikin were out that day. I don't know if you can remember, but it was a complete utter washout in the north of England that particular weekend. So it was hard, Pete, really hard. I think we went out with a mindset that we were going to fish no matter what happened, whether it was still water or running water, and we found somewhere in the end, but my God, it was hard. And it was a miserable day as well. It was cold and typical early season stuff. But by God, I'm glad of that day now. I can tell you now.
Yeah, it was exactly the same down here. And you sort of count, you know, I'm 53, nearly 54, and I don't sleep the bloody night before. It's pathetic. Mm. And you get so excited. And I got up, and like you say, the rivers were shot. And I'd been thinking about going right up the system into Dartmoor. And it was so miserable up there. But a friend of mine, Gerald, actually was up there. And a lot of other people, and you often up in that, and I'm sure in some of the streams when we come onto it, have a similar sort of case. And when you go right up the system, you often don't see many people. He said half a dozen people were around there, and obviously felt the same because winter had been such hard going as well, hadn't it, with lack of grayling fishing and everything else. I think everyone was desperate just to get out.
I think so, yeah. It was hard, wasn't it? It's been remarkably dry around my neck of the woods for a lot of the winter. I'm quite acutely tuned into it because of my work. A lot of my work's weather dependent. And November and December and January were really remarkably dry. They might not have always been particularly warm, but February just completely turned, didn't it? And wiped out any, you know, I usually try, there's one or two rivers near me where I can maybe get out and perhaps catch a grayling or two on dry flies. And once the large dark olive hatches start. I've got one or two rivers near me that are quite early, but no such chance this time. So as the clock ticked down towards the 15th, it was a proper kind of clean all the lines, clean all the rods, get everything out, check the leaders, all that sort of the ritual stuff that I don't usually bother with because I tend to fish right through the year to a greater or lesser degree. So it had a real kind of start to the season feel to it this year. And unfortunately, it's been cut off at source, hasn't it? First day out was quite an enjoyable one. We did catch fish. We ended up pulling dirty great streamers back on a trib that was clearing. It wasn't particularly clean, but it was clearing, and we had some success in the end. It was hard won.
Sometimes just being there's enough, isn't it?
Yeah, that's all that's needed. Getting out. That feels like more than enough now, doesn't it, as we speak now? Yeah. Just actually to stand by a river and look at it would do me now.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been, where I live, there's the walk, my hour that I'm allowed is across the lane and down the hill, and there's a stream there. Funnily enough, this morning, I think I saw a rising fish, which was really cool. And those things, like you say, they sort of lock away in your mind, don't they, and keep you just ticking over, and it seems as though the simple things are really having an impact now, aren't they?
Definitely. We've probably all got places that we go to in our imagination, haven't we? A kind of default bit of river or lake or whatever that you sort of spend all winter thinking about. It might not be where you fish all the time, but I know I'm you know, by default drawn to this one particular bit of river that I think about, and it's almost like a bereavement at the moment. It's, you know, there's several times during the day where it just pops into my mind, and you know, I'll be back there one day.
Yeah, we hope it's soon. And but you know, I guess as long as everyone's safe and healthy, that's the important thing right now. I think we're just going to see huge, great rush to the rivers and lakes and everything else. And I hope that sort of kind of is great to doing it, and people travel out as well and support businesses, you know, the tackle industry and small still waters and clubs and everything else. And it would be lovely to see this sort of big outrush to go out into the outdoors, which we're no doubt going to see, I guess, aren't we?
I think we are. Obviously, I've got the Lake District and the Dales and the Snowdonia Mountains not a lot far from me, and they're busy at any time of year. But I'd imagine the influx into the hills is going to be immense, isn't it? Whatever time we're allowed. I think from our point of view, it looks like we might miss the cream of the season, doesn't it, in terms of spring hatches and so on. So I could see perhaps, I mean, I'm speculating now, but if it's middle of summer when we're able to get out again, I might be heading for the hills myself, you know, because it might be the time of year when the rivers are not particularly in good nick, and I get a feeling I might just want to be by myself in the wild somewhere at that time.
Yeah. I think we're all going to feel the same, actually, aren't we? We're all going to dash out to our secret spots up the system. I'm sort of kind of pinning my hopes that there's an outside chance of early June or something, and we can, you know, we get a little mayfly hatch down here, and my hope is we catch that. And, you know, I'm sure you're the same, I'm thinking about Granham right now, and that's really for me on my home river getting underway now and in a pretty good way. And so I'm hopeful for that, but I'm hopeful that we do get that chance at mayfly. We take what we can right now, can't we? And you know, if it's a short season, I guess it's going to have to be a short season, isn't it?
Yeah. A fall of smut would do, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I'll take anything. I was hallucinating cutting my grass this afternoon, hallucinating about hawthorn fly, and thought, did I see some? And just as everything now is, it shows how your, like you say, the rhythm of your life and your thought process and everything is tied with other things, but how closely the rhythm is with your life as well, isn't it? And the seasons and the hatches and the fishing and everything that goes with it. So it'll be really interesting, and my fingers crossed that, you know, we are able to get people better and get outside and enjoy the fishing again, casting a line again. I've done enough casting practice, I can't do anymore. So I'll just wait. And I haven't, I know we were talking off mic about it, and are you've not really got tying yet, have you?
Well, a little bit in the last couple of weeks. I hadn't done much over winter. I was kind of forced to sort of get my backsiding gear and do a bit, because I had a couple of demos booked in the end of February, early March, at a couple of local, well, one was the guild and one was a club. And so I forced myself to practice, because I'm not a natural at anything. It takes, you know, loads of graft to kind of keep my eye on it, anything really. So I started with that, Pete, and I'd carried on really in readiness for the new season. I've been tying, as I mentioned just before, I've been tying a lot of dirty great streamers, which is completely alien to me. You know, I've got like, you know, size ones and two hooks here, which I don't really know what to do. So I bought more rabbit strips than I have done in my life over the last month, spinning all sorts of nasty furs together. And so I have been doing a little bit of tying recently, but I've been doing some model making as well. You know, those Ismo Pupper balsa wood jobs. Yeah. So that doesn't count as tying, does it?
Nice. And you'll see, thank you for your confession, but you're absolutely fine with streamers with me. And, you know, the snakes, I love pulling through a pool. They seem to work really well. The still water snake works really well for me.
unbelievable potential. It's like, I've been aware for sort of maybe 10 years now that we as a nation aren't latched onto the streamer thing to the degree that we could be. And I have been messing around with streamers myself for probably about that same sort of time, since probably about 2008, so maybe 12 years now. But it's only recently I've started to understand that I've just been playing at it, Pete. I've been fishing like sort of size 10 humongouses and little minkies and things like that. And we're only just scraping the surface there, aren't we? I mean, the stuff that I've got in my box here is kind of 3 to 4 inches long, but I think a lot of guys are using articulated things of maybe up to 5 inches long. It was a little mission of mine this year to really kind of dig into it, and to the degree, you know, you see there's guys like Martin Smith and so on who are a lot more in tune with this whole streamer ethic than the likes of I am. But I made it my business this year to try and get up to speed and see what the potential was, because I'm lucky to fish some rivers that hold big trout, and sure enough, there are certain times when you can catch them, you know, to the dry fly during the spring hatches and so on. But for the rest of the year, they quite often melt away. Be interested to explore some of those. Otherwise, you know, less often fish deeper pools and so on, I think. During flood water, you know, as well.
Yeah, and fish sort of size, they're going to be more likely to want a big meal, aren't they? And that's how you're going to find those sorts of fish as well. And it's a good tactic to use, isn't it?
Yeah, when you see half-pound trout charging into shoals of minnow, it kind of makes me wonder why I never latched onto it earlier. You know, I remember a few years ago standing on a bridge over the River Loon watching a trout that can't have been any more than 6 ounces in weight harassing a shoal of minnows. It was taking minnows and had them hanging out of its mouth with the tail hanging out of its gill. You know, it was barely big enough for it to swallow. This year is going to be the year when I actually get my backside in gear and try it out properly, I think.
Awesome. And we're going off, as I promised off Mike, that I go off all over the place, but we're going down an interesting rabbit hole with this. And so what is your approach for that? Are you fishing an intermediate line, a tip, or are you just floater? And how are you going fishing those deep holes?
Okay, well, when I first started years ago, initially, I got myself a couple of fast sinking lines and started trying to strip stuff very, very quickly without, you know, finding that particularly in the slower water, you're snagging the bottom very quickly if you weren't sort of quick with your retrieve. I've kind of gone a bit away from that now, and I tend to fish a floating line with one of a set of tips, if you like, from like a 5 foot, maybe die three type tip to a longer 5 or 6 inch a second thing. And I just find that it allows me to control the depth I'm fishing at a bit better in slower water, and I can shorten up and almost like, you know, jig the flies through more pocket water if required, fish whatever speed I like, really. And obviously allied to the weight of the fly, some are weighted and some are, you know, tungsten headed or fish skull headed, that kind of thing. My mate fishes on a full sinker, and does absolutely fine. I'm just sort of into a floater at the moment, really, and that kind of, it's almost like sink and draw kind of thing in the slower water.
I don't know,
I mean, you're talking to someone here who's just playing about with it at the moment. I can't speak from any authority on this at all.
it's kind of nice, and you know, I know you're a thinking angler, and so it's interesting for me and for the listeners to get a look inside your head and your thought process for it. And I know myself that our rivers probably aren't quite as deep and where I fish, so I fish a full intermediate. But I've always felt in my head that those bigger flies, and if I'm fishing a snake, for example, that the fish don't mind traveling for it if it's pulled a little bit quicker, or if it's not quite in the pocket for them, that they'll come and eat it because they've got that, it's calorific content and everything else. But it would be really interesting, and you've got me thinking about it. I've got a tip line, a sink tip that I've used in the past, but I've always felt, and I've used it for salmon as well, that I could keep the fly where, like you said about depth, I could keep it that way, particularly if I was moving it more quickly as well. But, you know, I suppose I could just put a heavier fly on, but it's a really interesting process, isn't it?
It is. I was doing a bit of pike fly fishing, and that got me thinking, because I started my default. Again, you know, not speaking from any authority, no one. I haven't spoken with any, expert pike fishermen, so I've been trying to find this all out for myself. But my default position with that when I started was to fish an intermediate, a fast intermediate, almost as if I was like lure pulling, if you know what I mean. And I had a bit of success. I could have probably done a bit better, but I found that when I went to a full floater and started fishing the flies, almost not at a standstill, but letting them almost fall to a standstill, I started getting an awful lot more takes when the fly was kind of just sort of hanging, almost motionless, which was a bit, if I think back to my childhood, that's how I caught them when I was fishing on plugs and wobbled dead baits and things like that. They didn't, a lot of the time, they weren't really all that interested in chasing. They'd take the bait as it was almost dead in the water. And so I started thinking maybe the same might apply to some trout fishing situations. I have had plenty of success ripping streams fast across pockets and things like that. And that's bloody exciting, isn't it? When a shallow, bouldery pocket water, when a fish charges out from a boulder and bow waves after the fly. But I have found that, particularly with unweighted flies, that kind of sinking tip just kind of allows you to just fish the fly in a controlled manner and just kind of like slow it right down. Sometimes it seems to help. But it's interesting. We've got an awful lot to learn as UK anglers generally. We've got a hell of a lot to learn, haven't we, on bait fish patterns for trout.
Yeah. The first time I pulled a streamer was in the States, I have to say, and I was aghast, you know, the first time it happened. And when I had that first take, I couldn't believe it. And that was it. And that got, as you say, it gets you thinking, doesn't it? And you think, right, how can I apply those things? And I think it's kind of interesting that you learn as you go along, rather than, because it's easier now in society to just throw that question out into whatever sphere that might be. But there's still something to be said for going out on the water and doing it and saying, well, that worked, that didn't work, that, you know, and that's a really probably the best way to learn as well, really, isn't it?
Totally agree, Pete. And it introduced an element of discovery and excitement to fishing, doesn't it? It's taken me back to the early days of when I was learning to upstream nymph, for these kind of like light bulb moments that, wow, that worked, that did work, and it was bloody exciting. And you know, if we, I don't know, we're never going to know it all, are we? But I sometimes feel that our UK fishing is so well covered now, isn't it, by various literature and online tutorials and social media and so on, that it's not so much, it's become more about like how many you can catch. The fact that we're going to catch fish is a given now, really, isn't it? And I don't know. I found it nice to have an avenue to explore that I hold my hands up and quite openly admit I know absolutely nothing about, and it's bloody good fun finding out. It really is.
Yeah. I must admit, I like pulling them quick because, like you say, that take just is awesome, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so I love it for that. But it's really interesting that, you know, in a couple of the podcasts I did with a couple of my fishing heroes, Charles Jardine and Pete Cockwell, and in those days, it's exactly what you're saying, that they would go out, learn about it, and then either write an article about it or write a book about it and learn that trade. And it's a really interesting way to go with that. And I'm like you, I'm a fiddler in the sense that I'm always trying to change something, or would that work, would that not work? And it's really, that's what keeps me coming back, I think, because I don't understand it, or I'd love to understand some more. So I try different things to see if that helps me learn a little bit more each time I'm out on the water.
Yeah, you could. The easy route would be to get into the ribs of someone who knows exactly what they're doing, wouldn't it? And kind of fast track your way to that knowledge. But, you know, that's no fun, is it? Well, I don't think it's any fun. I could understand if you know, maybe someone who's a little bit, relatively early days in the fishing journey, and it's more important to catch fish. I totally get that. But if you've been around the block a few times and catching fish isn't the be all and end all, then it's great fun to learn yourself, isn't it? Go through the trial and error and suffer the blanks and suffer the little victories and work it out for yourself. Even if the conclusions you arrive at are wrong.
Yeah. You probably do learn more from the blanks anyway, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I should know. I have plenty of them.
Yeah. Right. Well, let's go back a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about, so people can understand. We're going to, as I said, talk about the blog, talk about a bit more about your fishing and where you are. But where are you based, Matt? And, you know, I don't want you naming your honey holes and all that sort of stuff, but, you know, where are you based and what would be your home water if you want to name that? You don't have to if you don't want to.
Oh, it's okay. There's no secrets here, Pete. So I'm born and raised and still live to the north of Preston, Lancashire. So I'm a northwest lad. Which is a great location, really. You know, I'm a couple of miles off the M6 motorway, and I've got access to Cumbria and the lakes and the dales, and I'm about an hour off the Scottish border. I can even head sort of south into Derbyshire and North Wales and so on. So brilliant location. Although where I'm actually born and raised isn't really trout country as such. I live on the edge of the Fylde Plain, which is like a particularly flat bit of farmland between Blackpool and Preston. So my local river, I suppose you'd say, would be the Ribble. It's not the one I fish the most. It's a good river, probably a better migratory fish river than Brown Trout and Grayling River. But I spend probably most of my time heading north, turn the car north, away from the traffic, away from the towns and cities in this area, and up towards Cumbria and Scotland. Hmm. Yeah.
And so where did you mentioned that you were an angler from a young age. I guess you went the normal route from coarse fishing and along that sort of line, did you?
Definitely, Pete, yeah. Growing up in a sort of rural farming area, lads my age fished almost by default, you know. It didn't stick with everyone. It doesn't, does it? But everyone had a go, and it's farm ponds around here, little lowland brooks, you know, roach and rudd and tench and that kind of thing. And do you know what a snig is, Pete?
No.
I've always suspected this is a Lancashireism, but a snig around this neck of the woods is an eel. So we used to go snigging. Because a lot of the farm ponds in this area, the fishing's so poor that a lot of them don't contain what we call proper fish, you know, like roach and so on. Some of them are just like horrible tree-lined little mucky holes that hold a few eels. So a lot of my youth was spent chasing eels, can you believe? I miss them. I hated them at the time, absolutely hated them, but I've grown up with a massive affection for eels. I really have.
Really?
I haven't seen one for years.
Really? So does that sort of tempt you? You sort of kind of thinking in the back of your mind it would be nice to rekindle that just to to take you back or not?
Well, if the popular opinions to be believed, there aren't really many left, are there, eels? I think they're very scarce. Mm. That's really sad. It used to fascinate me how these things got into these little puddles and ponds that were miles away from any water course, any running water course anyway. I loved them, but I hated them, because anyone who's dealt with a sub 1 pound eel knows that it's just a whole world of pain. I do miss them, but I wouldn't be in a rush to catch one again, if I'm being honest.
Mind you, where our conversation started, I think subconsciously you're probably still thinking about with these huge, great streamers you're tying anyway.
Yeah.
where did fly fishing come in? How did that come about for you? How did you get into it? What sort of age were you when you started discovering fly fishing, and how did that come about?
Well, it'd be my dad, really. Bless him. He's a keen game fisherman, my dad. Not as keen as I am now, but he's always fished salmon fishing and a bit of put and take rainbow trout fishing on local waters. So it was my dad that got me fishing in the first place. But to his great credit, he never tried ramming fly fishing down my throat. He just set me off going with some rudimentary tackle and left me to my own devices. And then when I got a little bit older, he he probably suggested one day that I go and have a fish on. There's a local reservoir near us that has a nice line in stock rainbow trout, and I'll have gone with him a couple of times in my, I guess, probably early teens, Pete. But I wasn't really ready for it. I remember it was just so removed from my ethos at the time, which was to chuck a load of bait in and stay put and draw fish to me, and then, you know, pick them off. That this sudden change to from chucking smelly or visually appealing bait in and drawing fish to me to sticking a small hook with a bit of fur and feather on it that wasn't even real food out into the middle of nowhere and just expect something to grab hold of it. I just could not get my head around it at all. And obviously there's the technical aspect of casting, which is difficult for any young lad to grasp, isn't it? And so I think, if I remember rightly, our initial attempt probably resulted in me throwing a bit of a hissy fit and stropping off, you know. And again, my dad being the tremendously laid-back guy that he is, just didn't push it any further, you know. So I think it will have been... I left fishing alone, as a lot of lads do. We know when you get to kind of beer and birding age, you know, I left fishing alone for a few years while I went off to college and uni and so on. And when I came back to it in the end, I think it was probably a case of looking at all my manky old coarse tackle, which I was never a great maintainer of my gear, you know. I think my float rod, the tip had snapped, and I'd stuck an oversized ring off a spinning rod on the end, and mice will have eaten everything that was in my seat box, and there was probably a box full of dead flies and stuff. You know, I looked at my gear and I couldn't face refreshing it. And somehow the idea of lugging gear around and buying bait and so on just didn't appeal. I just thought, right, let's try this again. So I bought a cheap fly rod, a fly reel and line, and went out. And by that time I'd got to an age where I thought, well, look, people can and do catch fish using this mystical method, so why can't I? I'll teach myself. So that's how it started, really. Yeah. What I'm trying to say, in summary, is I think I reached a level of maturity where I could handle it, whereas before I was just a spoiled little kid. So
yeah. And I guess you didn't look back from there. But what were you doing when once that first fish came? I guess that was on a lake. Were you fishing with your dad when that happened, or were you on your own, or where was that was all that took place? And was that a defining moment for you, that you suddenly thought, actually, yeah, I get this now, and that was it, and the cast was dying?
I think so, yeah. We will have been fishing, if I remember right, it'll have been one or two places. It would have either been Barnesfold Reservoir, which is the aforementioned local stocked fishery, or Bankhouse up at Caton, which is a tremendous little fishery. I don't know if you know it, run by Ben Dobson, who runs Stocks Reservoir. Very small water. You know what I sort of refer to as a trout master's venue, you know, like a small water with some quite large trout in it. And I've been with my dad. I think I was probably on Barnesfold, to be honest with you. And it was a slow process, a really slow process, lots of like blanks or maybe just one fish. But that kind of sudden life at the end of the line, you know, that kind of, because I'll have been either fishing nymphs or lures or something, so I won't have been on dry flight at that stage. So that kind of a shudder down the line, and all of a sudden, bloody hell, there's something there, and that's what got me. Although I would say that it was only really a few years down the line from that when I got myself back on running water. I'd always preferred running water as a kid, you know, fishing for chub and so on local brooks. When I got myself back on running water, that was when fishing in general took on a whole new meaning for me. I found myself reaching a level of obsession I just had never had in my life previously. Something clicked into place, and yeah, that was the start of the slippery slope downhill, I think.
I'm with you. I love what you're saying. My tackle even now is shambolic. The state of it and everything else, and people ask me stuff. I said, well, I don't know, you know, I can usually find something that'll work on it, and bits and pieces like that. And it's interesting, my path is similar in sense of a still water to a river, which I think was very much the standard way of going about things. And I remember actually, when you were talking about that, the first fish I caught, and it was a whiskey fly, and I was so dumbfounded. I netted it. It was a put and take, so I took it, and I left, and the bloke said, "Where are you going?" I said, "I've caught a bloody fish." You know, I was so surprised I caught one. I went home, you know, with the hunter-gatherer thing, that I'd caught a fish. I was just absolutely shocked by it. But it's interesting now, isn't it? Because, and it's kind of cool to see that that traditional path of it might be still water, a small still water, then it might be a reservoir, then it might be moving water, is a little bit different now. And it's kind of cool that people are now perhaps going straight to rivers and finding wild fish in interesting places as well. And that seems to be part of it as well.
Yes, I think people, for whatever reason, are starting to maybe see the appeal. And I don't know, maybe there isn't just quite the mystique that there once was around river fishing. I mean, I remember distinctly reading copies of Trout Fisherman magazine when I was, you know, in my buzzers under bungs days, and occasionally they'd throw in a random article, wouldn't they, about have a go at fishing your local river. And I remember reading those and thinking, oh, that's far beyond me. I got matching the hatch. I wouldn't even know what I was looking at, you know. And it seems like, it seemed to me like an unattainable goal. And I think maybe whether it's social media, Pete, I don't know. I think people are maybe less frightened of it. I know my friend Stuart, who has done. Actually formally quit guiding now, but obviously he's spent a lot of his life guiding, tells me numerous people that he's had who want to learn how to fish on a river, which is, I suppose, perhaps from your point of view as a guide, maybe quite a difficult job compared with first going out and maybe having a few casting lessons or so on. But I've got a friend, just to give you an example, I've got a friend now, a good mate of mine, Jimmy, who I've recently got in touch with after not seeing him for many years, because he got in touch with me because he wanted to learn how to fly fish on a river. And obviously I'm not in any way qualified. As I've explained to him, I did suggest he sought professional advice, you know, but I have been kind of like trying to show him the rudimentaries of river fishing. And for Jimmy, he said he wants to fish rivers and he wants to catch wild trout. That's what has piqued his interest from the start.
It's kind of interesting. I wonder if that is, like you say, the reach of social media and where fly fishing in other countries like the US, Scandinavia is deeply cool, younger people are doing it, that's perhaps had an impact on people saying, actually, I like the culture of that, but I also like the idea of going out as much as we can, do it in the UK, comparable to Scandinavia or America, and going out in essence off the grid a little bit more and going to find some wild fish, walking a little bit and doing things along those sorts of lines. I don't know. Do you think that might be part of it?
Definitely. I mean, if you look at Instagram and so on, there's so much material there that would stimulate someone's interest, isn't there? You know, it's really appealing. You know, these pictures are beautifully presented, beautiful fish in fantastic surroundings. It's got a slightly less stuffy feel to it now, UK fly fishing, hasn't it, these days? I think it'll continue to get more and more. I don't want to say the word trendy because I don't think it'll ever be trendy, but you know what I'm saying, don't you? And I think that in itself is probably more appealing than the image of, you know, sometimes they could look quite lame, stockfish, can't they? Quite a lame looking stockfish in a put and take fishery that, you know, it's not just, doesn't carry quite the same sort of story with it, does it?
No.
And I think the fact that that's out there, that portrayal of fly fishing, that look, we're out there, we're doing interesting stuff, we're out where no one else goes, we're seeing things that no one else sees. I think that, the fact that now that message is available for people to see, I think probably inspires quite a lot of people.
Yeah, it's interesting actually, coming back to what you were saying about guiding, we didn't do anything on ponds or lakes or anything, everything was on the river. And so it was kind of interesting. I started my career with Nick and we were on the fishery there, and I learned so much in that time. But 16 years later, it's kind of nice to have been spending a large part of that on the river teaching people. It makes you a better instructor. It makes you a better fisherman, actually. And, you know, putting a rod in somebody's hand who's never done it before yet, you've got to teach them all of those things, not hook a fish for them and get them to cast an upstream fly. It's kind of fun and stimulating on a, you know, if you're doing it 7, 6 days, 5 days a week, it's kind of stimulating to do that. Rather than, you know, as you say, you could put a bung on and a buzzer or whatever and catch fish. Nothing wrong with that at all. And that's a great way to get people into it. But looking at it from the inside out, it's actually kind of interesting to be on a river with somebody that can kick your backside a lot more easily. And so it's kind of cool to see that. And that's where we concentrated on getting people. And I said, we live in Devon. We've got all these lovely streams here. You know, you want to try fish those. So it's a really interesting to see. It feels as though that dynamic has changed a little bit, and I hope that isn't at the cost or expense of small still waters, because they have such an important part to play in fishing as well.
I was hoping you'd say that, because I gather the still water scene is maybe suffering a bit of a downward curve at the moment from what I hear, and that's a massive shame, because they are the really valuable fisheries, aren't they? And you know, I would never, although my small still water experience was kind of like a ladder on my fishing journey, I would never talk about them in disparaging terms, and you know, because there's a lot of fun to be had there, and the fish is by no means easy, and it's the accessible way in, isn't it? And it's a vital route in to fly fishing for people who perhaps wouldn't know where to go, perhaps, you know, wouldn't know where to travel or what day tickets to buy. You know, the river fishing thing is one thing I found out with my lad who's not particularly interested in fishing now, to be honest with you, but he's 13, and I have had a go with him, and my mate Jimmy, who I just mentioned, is one thing that I've realized, and this is from my, you know, unqualified position, is that getting someone fishing and catching fish in a river isn't actually all that hard, is it? I mean, I listened to your previous podcast with Andy Buckley earlier in the week, which I found was really interesting. I've never met Andy, but I liked a lot of what he said. I could relate very much to a lot of what he said, yeah. And he made some very good points about the French leader, didn't he? Because I know you and I were talking about this a couple of weeks ago, and the does it dumb down fly fishing argument. But I think I said to you, Pete, that it's probably the easiest way of extracting fish from a river, isn't it? If you were gonna teach a beginner to catch fish from a river, that's you know, I think I said to you, I could get someone, a kid catching fish within half an hour on a river on a French leader if there were fish there to be caught. And so it's interesting to hear Andy say that, you know, that's exactly how he kind of like approached it from his point of view as a very valuable method. And I think if we can get beginners in that way rather than maybe just defaulting to still waters because it's perceived to be easier when it isn't necessarily always easier, I think that's got to be a good thing, hasn't it?
Yeah, no, I'm with you. And that point he made, I think, was absolutely spot on. I was trying at the time and to sort of take it in a slightly different directions in a sense of people using that to get photographs, to get and along a different line. But that point he made was much more pertinent, much more important. And as you say, if it gets people who haven't fished, and particularly younger people as well, because you want them catching fish to keep them interested. And if that's a way to do it, you can take them to a stunning little stream and they can catch some fish. Well, that's kind of cool. So I'm all for that. You know, it's not a, certainly from my point of view, and I think we said at the time, I can't quite remember now, but I think it's a valuable and useful tool. And for me, you know, I was saying I wasn't using it on our rivers here. We had no water and I didn't think it was right at the time to fish that sort of method when the fish were all stacked up in one sort of place, I guess. So, but I think that's dead right. And, you know, there were arguments in a similar sort of line with Tenkara and other sort of methods to encourage and bring people into fishing without having to learn the technicalities of fishing, so you can get them on the river and off they go very, very quickly, I guess.
Yeah, but you make a good point, or you allude to a good point there, that about the technicalities. The flip side of the argument is that if that's the way you learn to fish, and that's as far as you choose to take it, then have you really learned how to fly fish at all? Which is a good question, a difficult one to answer, really, because I don't think there's any doubt there is a sizable proportion of the next generation of fly fishermen who are probably very, very kind of leader to hand centric, aren't they? And because it's successful, and because you know it gets a lot of fish, lots of photos of fish, lots of social media likes, and so on, it confers a kind of ability, doesn't it? And obviously every branch of our sport requires ability to become competent at. But my own view is that I think fly fishing as a whole, to be considered a competent fly fisherman, you should be able to employ all the different aspects, you know, shorter casting, longer casting, sunk floating fly methods, short line methods, everything. And I'm not sure if, I don't know, does our current generation have that? Are we able to pass that down? Like upstream wet fly fishing in my neck of the woods, which has a generations long tradition, has more or less died out, Pete, to be honest. I can count on one hand the number of people I'm aware of who have and know how to fish the wet fly upstream.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, isn't it? And it is, you know, I think without going, and we won't go down the social media thing, but it is kind of interesting that we can use all these other methods to tempt fish as well. And I guess it is, we're all different, and fishing's a microcosm of life as well. And, you know, I think part of this comes from maturity. As you get a little bit older, a little bit more relaxed, it's not about catching lots of fish, particularly if you're a river angler as well. I think that with that sort of maturity, I just go, if I catch a fish, cool. The reason I love it, and I said elsewhere, is that coming from a sporting background, the casting is a pleasing part of it. So I want to try and make a good cast. And then if that catches a fish, that's part of that process for me. And nymphing can work really well. I enjoy that as well. But like I've said before, I only like to fish that during the winter. I think that's the appropriate method for me to fish for grayling in the winter, unless they're rising, you know, October, November, we get them rising here and I've got a chance at them then. But that, I think, is the right time. The rest of it, I'll stick with casting a fly line because I like it, but it's not me preaching. That's what I kind of like doing, to be honest.
Yeah. I think we've got such a broad range of techniques at our disposal these days, haven't we? I think we owe it to the fish that are in our rivers to be fair, few fish are safe from us anglers now, are we? The methods that we can deploy, we've discussed a couple of them, you know, the sort of the French leader and streamer fishing and so on, means that really, like, no fish are out of bounds, are they, anymore? And I think we've got a duty of care to exercise a bit of discretion at times. And it's easier for us more experienced guys to talk about that, because there's less of a pressure on us. We're not all that bothered about numbers anymore, are we? But we've also got to respect, I think, that everyone's on a different stage in their own fishing journey, aren't they? And I'm sure you can too, but I can clearly remember the days when I wanted to empty the river of fish, you know, a phase I went through where I set about every day, and my little target was to adapt my methods to the message that the conditions and the fish were giving me, and optimize my catch rate for the entire day, which I suppose, and this is a non-competition angler speaking, I suppose that was probably as near to a competition mindset as I ever got. I was trying to demonstrate to myself that I could use a variety of methods and read the water and the conditions correctly. So it was a phase that I went through where that was important, but it's not important to me anymore. But I do accept that is important to some people. But I think, you know, I don't know. It's there's no sanctuary for fish anymore, is there, on rivers a lot of the time? And I just think sometimes I think we, you know, we've nothing to prove to other people or ourselves, have we? I think we perhaps just, you know, need to show the fish a bit more respect sometimes as an angling community.
Yeah. There was interesting, actually, and there's while you mentioned about that, that somebody contacted me after one of the podcasts and said, I love, you know, he was very complimentary about the podcast. He said, one of the problems, he said, I can't remember who I'd done the podcast with, he said, but the thing for yourself and the person, you get to fish a lot. I don't get to fish a lot. So I'll, you know, that's my couple of days, 2-3 days a year. So I'm going to do everything I possibly can, I guess. And it really made me think, and I guess you're similar to me in that you get to fish a little bit. And so you get more than those couple of days of the year. So I guess, you know, that's a very valid and fair point as well, that not everyone can fit the amount of days that we're very fortunate enough to spend on the river. So there's that angle as well. But I'm with you in that I think, you know, we do sometimes leave a pool alone if it's been good to you for a bit. And I'm even to the stage, you know, if I'm salmon fishing early season, I catch a trout and it makes me sad because I think, oh, that might have been one I might have got a crack at when he was rising, and whether he's going to do that now. And, you know, it's kind of interesting. And I'm convinced in my mind it's a maturity thing, that as I get older, I don't need them all. I don't need, you know, a couple of fish here and there is great. A few hours. I don't fish. I don't know if you're the same. Do you fish for a whole day, or how do your day structure now?
Needs must, Pete. Due to work commitments and family commitments, I a big chunk of my fishing is done on summer evenings after work, which can be, you know, successful to a greater or lesser degree. Our evening sports seems to be getting worse every year, I would say. If I'm out for the day, I don't know. I don't fish as hard as I used to. I like a bit of company more than I used to as well. So I'm usually fishing with a mate, and you'll know yourself, there's an awful lot of chin wagging and chewing the fat and ligging around doing not a lot at all, is it? And not so much fishing, particularly if it's one of those sort of spring hatch dry fly driven days where you're on the lookout for a good fish. I mean, sometimes you can barely make a cast all day. But there was a time, I mean seriously there was a time when Saturdays used to be my day, and my wife would be at work. We didn't have any kids then, so every Saturday, and when it got to like the dog days in July and August, I'd be up at 3 a.m. up the motorway fishing at dawn. I'd have a sleep in the grass when I got tired, then I'd start again. I knew I was flogging a dead horse, but I just fished all day until I could fish no longer, Pete.
Yeah, I was the same. I think I've said on one of these that my friend Ray, that I used to fish a lot with, is from the States. And we used to go all over the place fishing, and we wouldn't eat or anything. And I remember distinctly we were fishing in Dorset on the Piddle. And I said, dude, we've got to eat. I'm absolutely knackered. You know, we'd started at silly o'clock in the morning to drive down there and fish. And now it's kind of, you know, part of it for me is the breakfast beforehand, a good cup of coffee, chat about stuff. And sometimes we'll be sitting there at 10 o'clock. So should we go then? And it's kind of nice. I like that part of it as much. Yeah. That is part of it. And I guess, I don't know if that is the maturity thing again. I don't know, because I wasn't like that. And I'm sure loads of people who are much younger than me are hitting the river and running to the river, getting into their waders. But as you get older, it doesn't matter, does it? And it's kind of interesting that dynamic changes a little bit, I think.
It does. I mean, I mentioned that I like a bit of company as well. But, you know, when I was younger, I went fishing for the solitude of it. And I still, don't get me wrong, I still do like to fish on my own at the right time. it allows a complete disconnection, doesn't it, from the everyday. But yeah, somewhere along the line, it became as much a social thing, really. I don't mean social as in big groups of people, but, you know, I mean, I have a mate, Dave, who lives down in Gloucester, who a day's fishing with Dave is an absolute delight. You just know there's going to be next to no fishing done, but the barbecue will come out at lunchtime and there'll be bottles of beer. And those are very, very special days, even though we seldom catch much, you know.
Yeah, and I know you fish with Lee Evans a bit, and they're sort of days like that as well, aren't they?
That's right. Yeah. Well, the Dave in question is Dave Smith, a friend of Lee Evans is. So that little group, they come up here quite regularly. I try to join them as often as I can. Yeah. It's a great crack.
Yeah, it is. I think spending time on the river, and it's, I think I've talked about it before, is you've got to have the right people though, haven't you? When you fish with them, that you've got to know they don't mind if you're sharing a rod, they're going to hand you the rod, you're going to get a go, and you sort of walk up together. Because somebody said to me, you know, I don't really get it when you say you're going fishing with someone, you split up and then see each other at 4 or 5 o'clock and that's it. That's not to me what it's about. I love, you know, if you're semi-guiding each other, or like you say, chatting away, or let's sit down for 10 minutes. And that part of it is really cool. I think, funnily enough, since I've quit guiding now, that I kind of like being on my own, because I spent so much bloody time with people on the river that I'm actually enjoying being, I don't know if it's right to say it, but a tiny bit selfish and going fishing on my own every now and again. And I love fishing with friends. And like you, I'm very lucky. I have lots of friends that I go fish with, but I actually am quite enjoying those little snatches of fishing on my own as well, and reconnecting with it in a different way.
Mm. Is it fair to say, would you say that you fish your best when you're on your own?
Definitely.
Because I definitely do. Yeah, concentration and the willingness to try one or two things that maybe you might feel a bit self-conscious about doing in company, you know. I definitely fish better and catch better fish when I'm on my own, but, you know, who cares? Who cares? It's all good.
I know I'm in the zone when I start talking to myself. I talk to my dog because he comes with me a lot of the time now, but I talk to myself and I sort of say to the trout, I knew you were there. And when it rises, sometimes they stick, sometimes they don't. Like you say, it doesn't matter. But when you're in that zone and you're with one with everything, it's kind of cool and really enjoyable, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. There's the zone. I know it's a cliche, isn't it? But you only really get into the zone when you're on your own. And if you're in the midst of a hatch, and just for that kind of half hour that feels like a lifetime, everything just falls into place. And it's the sort of thing that you spend days afterwards replaying in your mind, isn't it? Those few minutes. You seldom get that with company, but it's a different pleasure.
Yeah, it is. You're dead right about that. And I really enjoy that part of it. So let's talk a little bit, I guess. You mentioned your dad was into migratory fish. Are they anything that you've ever, has it always been trout and grayling for you?
Pretty much. I did. Here's an interesting thing. My dad fishes the upper loon for salmon. And it's not really fly fishing. There's bait fishing involved and all sorts of dark arts. It's kind of, if you saw the water, you'd kind of understand, really. I think there's certain bits that he'll fly fish, but a lot of it doesn't really lend itself to it. And when he used to take me up as a lad, I didn't get the fishing side of it at all. It just seemed that we were going for a day out and dad never caught anything. And we'd come home and he'd moan to my mum about the lack of fish in the river. And that just seemed to be what he did. But what I didn't realise at the time was that for a young lad who grew up in like the flat farmlands of the Fylde Plain, he was taking me to a place that's completely different, which is that kind of like the upper sort of the Howgill Fells and the upper Loon Valley. And that was something that I didn't realise at the time, but kind of must have got in under my skin a little bit, because those are the sort of places that I subsequently became drawn to. And I think my dad, his influence, without probably trying, was a lot greater than he maybe he realizes. So there came a time when I naturally wanted to follow in his footsteps, Pete. So I learned this kind of like low water worm and shrimp freelining kind of thing that he does. That's a bit of a relic method of these northern spate streams. You don't see it done much anymore, and it's generally frowned upon. But it's quite fascinating because it's to sighted fish that might be in the bottom of a 15 feet deep dub. And that really got under my skin for a while. It's not particularly productive sport, but it's interesting. It's just interesting to see the reaction of fish to what you put in front of them. And I think, like, talking to my dad now these days, he's got to an age where he's actually not bothered at all if he catches or not. He just kind of like likes to see a fish. He's made up if he finds a fish in the lie that he expects it to be. All these little nooks and crannies under boulders and down rock edges and on the edge of white water chutes and things like that. It's the sort of thing that you put your Polaroid glasses on and need years of experience to actually understand what you're looking for at what water heights, you know. So that really is my only dalliance with silver tourists, Pete. I enjoyed it for a while, but I found that needing water conditions to be right, whether it was a flood or whether it was fining down or whether it was low water to look for them or whatever, I found that it was just too much of a frustration for me to be at work and know that that was the moment I needed to drop everything and go, and I couldn't. And I had, after a couple of seasons where I did quite well and had sort of half a dozen or eight fish at the back end of the season, I had a couple where I either blanked or caught one, and it just wasn't really worth persisting with a subscription. So I kind of got out of it again, really. I go occasionally to watch my dad, because I enjoy that, but that's it. I won't lie, I've got no desire whatsoever to fish fly for salmon. I've got great admirations for the guys who do it, and I love to see a good double-handed caster in action. I'd love to be able to do that, but I don't feel the pull. I wouldn't mind going nighttime sea trout fishing, if I'm being honest.
But
one day. There's not enough time, Pete, is there? There's just not enough time.
No, absolutely. We're busy with other parts of the life, and you choose, I think, where you feel most comfortable and most happy, which is, if you've got a day's fishing or a few hours, that's what you go for, isn't it? And that's where you migrate towards.
To sum it up in one sentence, Pete, I don't think I could be fishing for salmon while there were trout rising all around me. I don't think I could do it. I haven't got the minerals for it. I'd be getting the single hander out. Yeah.
Very, very fair comment. Now we're going to take it in a slightly different direction, and try and pull it back to what I was hoping to go, but it's been fascinating going all down all sorts of different directions, and I'm really, really enjoying it. But I was a really avid reader of your blog, The North Country Angler, and used to, I think you and a couple, I think Gareth down in South Wales, and there's a few other people who had those blogs at the time. How did that come about for you? Because you are very eloquent, and it was it just a natural thing that you wanted to share what you were doing and sharing those experiences that you were having on the river?
Yeah, I think it was just probably a natural and enthusiasm. It wasn't because I harboured any desire to have what I wrote read by anybody. I didn't really ever think that would happen. But it was a time when, as you've rightly said, there were quite a few. It was the done thing, wasn't it? There were a lot of blogs starting. I like the idea of it. I'd always kept an angling diary, and it kind of felt like a logical progression to expand a little bit and stick it online. One of the other motivations was, do you know Jeff Johnston, who's a Cumbrian guy? Yeah, Eden Angler, yeah. Sorry, yeah. At the time, Jeff had a website called Eden Angler, which obviously still does, but this was a previous incarnation of it. Wasn't so much guiding orientated, because I'm not sure if he was guiding per se then, but it read a bit like a blog. He'd write little narratives of his days fishing in the Eden Valley, and I absolutely loved it. He had a really brilliant, straightforward, no nonsense way of describing his days fishing and how he went about it, and that really got under my skin. I loved Jeff's website, and when he ended it, he took it down for whatever reason. A year or two later, when I was looking at these angling blogs and was sort of thinking about maybe having a go myself, part of what drove me was I thought if anyone out there could derive even an ounce of the pleasure that I got from reading Jeff Johnson's stuff, then it'd be worth doing, you know. So I don't get me wrong, I'm not saying I was picking up where Jeff left off because I wasn't, but that was kind of part in my mind. I thought if someone can, it's the local interest thing, isn't it? You know, if someone can kind of like share what's going on in their local rivers a little bit, and if someone else finds it interesting, then it's been worth doing. So that was part of it as well, really. But you know, mainly nine tenths, it was just kind of like really a sort of extension of my angling diary, I think is how it started.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because I was speaking to somebody the other day about it, and he said now, instead of, and we said we were both terrible about keeping diaries, but he said he was using Instagram as his diary these days. So he knows the dates of whatever, because I can't remember anything, but I kind of, it's in my head, and I want to try and, when I can't get on the river, replay everything in my head. Whether that works or not, I don't know, but I don't have books to go back on, and you have my utmost respect for doing that. But I guess, you know, it was a really, really popular, well thought of blog. Did you have lots of people contacting you as a result of that and asking you advice, and it was drawing people to your neck of the woods to want to go and fish, having seen what you were getting up to?
The latter, to a degree, yeah. I think it resulted in quite a few queries about local fishing and you know, where could day tickets be procured for these, this, that, and the other bits. You know, I didn't get people, you know, looking for advice really, and any queries at all only came quite late on, because I think the thing ran for about 12 years, but the first 5 or 6 years it might as well have been, you know. Might as well have not existed, really. These things are so slow mine was so slow to gain any sort of traction at all. But by the end, I was getting quite a few contacts, or, you know, from people who wanted information in the local area, really. Yeah.
And did you have anyone, I know you've touched on it before, but did you have anyone wanted you to take them out and guide you?
Occasionally, I avoided it because I would point them in the direction respectfully of someone who knew what they were doing. You know, other guys in the area like Stuart Minikin and Jeff Johnson and Jeremy Lucas and so on. I like to think maybe people understood from the way I put it across that I wasn't trying to expertise, as John Gearak once said. I never tried to portray myself as anyone who had the slightest clue what they were doing. So I think I think people must have latched onto that, because I didn't get asked for work very much. No.
And so you said you ran the blog for 12 years, and then you closed it down. And was there it run its natural course, or you just felt that was enough after 12 years?
Yeah, I think it ran its course, Pete. It was these things, like all sort of social media streams, rely on kind of being constantly bumped to the front of people's consciousness, don't they? And just a few things, you know, work and life pressures. You know, my kids growing up and starting to do a little bit of published work as well started to suck my time in other directions. And the blog at that point had got to less a kind of weekly updated journal kind of thing to like more sporadic but more lengthy rambling type stuff, and it was harder to find the time to do that, and I was finding it was just kind of sitting there stagnating, really. Whole months passing without being updated, part of me wanted to keep it going, part of me wishes I still had, and maybe updated it and transferred it from being a free blog platform to perhaps a proper website, you know. But it's just like everything in life, it's time, isn't it? Yeah, so I did the honourable thing and gave it a respectful funeral in the end and removed it altogether.
And you said that published work, and I know I enjoyed the articles you have written for Trout and Salmon, and you know, I was absolutely thrilled that you're in the current fly culture as well. Did you find that was a natural progression? Do you find writing, is that a background that's always been of interest to you? Is it, have you, do you find it easy to write?
I can find it easy to write, Pete, but a lot of the time I don't. It doesn't come naturally. But you see, that was the beauty of the blog. It was kind of there to offload on when I had something to say, or when I felt that I was in the mood for committing pen to paper. So the published side of things is a lot harder, isn't it? Because you are you're doing work for someone, aren't you? And that may involve a deadline, and it'll involve a brief, and that whole imposition of a task, I find makes it 10 times harder. I really do, because I'm not a natural writer. I think I've always enjoyed it. I maybe didn't realise for many years in my life. But yeah, no, it doesn't come naturally. If I'm not in the mood, I might as well, I might as well not bother.
Yeah. I remember, and you were one of the very few people, and I mean this, when I was bringing, I saw you at the BFFI, and when I was thinking of bringing fly culture, and I spoke to you and I said, I'd really love you involved. And you said, keep me in touch, because you were going through a spell then where you felt you couldn't really write. It was only a short spell, I think, but you just felt at that moment in time, you weren't really ready to do it. And I know exactly what you mean with that. And right now, not being able to fish, I'm finding it easier to write, funnily enough. And I'm putting short little essays on the Fly Culture website, the Facebook page, sorry. And I did one this morning about just being a fishing guide, and then one about the little stream that I walk along every day and how you feel differently about it when you can't fish it, sort of thing. And it's funny the things that can trigger. Do you find that something will trigger an idea and you just go whack and it happens?
Absolutely, yeah. It has to mean something. It has to be something that you feel, doesn't it? The thing that I love about fly fishing is the feelings that it instills in you. You know, that there's a kind of natural desire to articulate that somehow, isn't it? Whether it's just yarning to a friend over a pint in the pub or trying to write something. You look at our branch of the sport as like such a rich literary history, doesn't it? Fantastic writing, fantastic creative and imaginative and evocative writing that I'd suggest other branches of fishing don't really have. They don't command that kind of range of emotions, I don't think. So it's those things, isn't it? I think we're so closely attached to the environment and the ebbs and flows of the seasons, aren't we? And the flow that the same way our water flows, the whole environment flows around, doesn't it? And I think sometimes we can't help it. We're just touched by something that we feel, aren't we? And that's what kind of inspires me to get going. Rather than any desire to try and expound theories or techniques or anything like that.
Yeah. I find it easier to write about going or what something means rather than a how-to. I've written how-tos, but I'd much prefer to write something about whatever, and fishing may be the thread that holds that together sometimes, but yes, it's very, very interesting. So we've touched on it a little bit. How do you think fishing looks to you right now? Is it in a good place? Is it in a bad place? How does it feel?
Well, that's a difficult question. It feels like it's a sport of declining participation, but I'm not convinced it's in a. I think there's life in the old dog yet. You hear a common complaint is that there's no kids coming into the sport, don't you? There's no youth, but I'm not completely convinced I buy that. I mean, I don't disagree. I don't think there are many kids coming to the sport. But then I seem to remember as a young lad myself, I used to read the Angling Times, and there'd be people like Mark Downs and Des Walker complaining that there weren't kids coming to the sport then. And I just think, you know, society's focus shifts, doesn't it? I mean, our focus was probably shifted by things like watching football and watching the telly. It was always the telly with us, wasn't it? You know, don't sit in front of the telly, you'll get square eyes. Well,
yeah.
my kids now, it's not the telly, it's the tablet or the Xbox or whatever, you know. And a friend of mine made a good point a while ago when we were discussing this. He said, well, okay, there aren't kids coming to the sport, but then, you know, is fly fishing really a kid's sport? Isn't it something that people, and we alluded to this earlier, people turn to when they gain a certain degree of maturity? You know, it might be that you move through course fishing or whatever route, or a lot of people that I'm aware of have come completely from the cold to fly fishing. You know, I mean, again, my mate Jimmy, at the ripe old age of his late 30s, you know, he's the keenest person I've ever met. He's absolutely consumed by it. But you can't. It's difficult to see how the Jimmy that I knew at the age of 18 would have felt the same way, you know. So I think there's always going to be people, you know, of kind of like in their sort of late 20s, 30s, coming into the sport. I think that will slowly, you know, take over where us old codgers end up leaving off.
Yeah. I'm involved. Sorry,
Pete. Go on.
I was going to say, all the conversations I've tended to have about this is that I've not really seen or heard a lot of negativity about it. You know, we're seeing, as you say, the declining numbers. And, you know, I've said many times on these that I think the Stillwater boom is making that look worse than it possibly is. I think people are coming to it, as you say, and we've discussed a little bit later, so maybe 20s, 30s, that sort of age, and going straight in at the river level. So that seems pretty okay from that point of view. And, you know, that I think after everything, when this calms down, and I hope it does, and like we said, everyone's fit and well, that I wonder if we might see a little bit of a rush for people want to get out in the great outdoors, and fishing may be a part of that. I think the Bob Mortimer and Paul Whitehouse program has done nothing but good for fishing, and things like that, I think, are helping the cause a little bit as well. We're going to be a niche always, aren't we? And I kind of like that anyway, but it doesn't feel as though it's sort of in a really grim and dark place to me right now.
No, I agree, Pete. And it's like we alluded to before, isn't it, on the sort of social media streams portraying this more dynamic, attractive aspect of what wild trout and migratory fish, fly fishing, is all about. I think more people were aware of what fly fishing as a niche of fishing is all about, I think it'd be more popular. Because, you know, how many times do you get asked at parties or social gatherings, you know, when someone lets slip that, oh, such and such, you know, Matt fishes, and it's like, oh no, please. And then you get the inevitable barrage of questions like, you know, oh, how can you be so patient, and how can you sit there in one place for so long, and do your fingers not smell after you've been, and all that sort of thing? And I used to try and tell these people, I used to try and educate these people and tell them, no, that's not what it's all about, blah, blah, blah. And I, after suffering so many blank faces and stifled yawns, I just don't bother anymore. I just try to change the subject.
Yeah, I'm exactly the same. Don't bring up fishing, and no, invariably it does, but don't bring it up. I said, because once I get my teeth in, I ain't going to stop. So you need to understand that and try and divert it off in a different direction. And, you know, I usually, like you say, I don't sit under an umbrella. I use a fly rod, and I'm not J.R. Hartley.
Yes,
and
that's
then
it.
That's it. Yeah,
I don't wear briefs.
And then you can usually, yeah, you can usually cut it off from there. So, but that's encouraging to hear, and fingers crossed that it continues. And we're lucky. There's some wonderful anglers around at the moment, and that are younger, that are forging ahead. And I'm so pleased to to see that and be lucky to know some of them too. What about traveling for fishing? Have you, you know, does where you live, because it sounds as though you're positioned perfectly for fishing. Is there, do you tend to travel abroad for fishing? Have you traveled abroad? Or does your neck of the woods have everything that you really need?
I haven't done much traveling, Pete, and it's more due to my personal circumstances, really. I came to fly fishing in a serious way in my early 20s, by which point I was kind of already on the verge of settling down and moving house with my good lady wife. And you know how, you know, the hamster wheel goes, you get a house together, you do the house up, you have kids. And you know, and I'm at a stage in my life where, you know, in my early 40s, my kids are perhaps just starting to come out the other side. You know, my kids are 14 and 11. But, you know, up until this point, the prospect of me gallivanting off to do a week's fishing in Cuba or, you know, Montana, just it's just not on the cards at all. My missus, she'll quite quickly remind me that a lot of my fishing friends are either single or divorced, you know. I mean, longer term, it's definitely something I've got. You know, I've got a whole bunch of plans. I've done a little bit in Canada. We have some relations in British Columbia, and I've been over a couple of times and done a little bit of not really serious, just packed a bit of travel gear and done a little bit of fishing on like the Bow River and so on. Which has been an eye opener.
That's an amazing river, isn't it? The Bow. I've heard good things.
Yeah. It's a big, scary river. The ever present threat of bear attack adds a little bit of excitement to it. in the more rural bits of it, caught an awful lot of Rocky Mountain whitefish. They're considered trash fish, aren't they?
I like them. Mm.
Yeah.
So where is your dream destination? Where would you love to go fish, and what would you like to experience when you're there?
I'd be less inclined to do the sort of stock in trade, New Zealand, Montana, maybe even Iceland kind of thing. Iceland does appeal, I have to admit, but If time and money were no object, I'd like to head to the most remote corners of the planet that I could find. Maybe Russia, parts of Russia or South America. You know, the unusual stuff that that maybe you don't hear all that much about. Strange corners of Alaska and so on. You know, rather than the honeypots. I've got the first clue about how I'd go about doing that, but occasionally, you know, like some of the likes of John Gearack type writing that I've come across in the past, talking about big brook trout in remote corners of is it Newfoundland, the brook trout,
Newfoundland, Labrador,
that sort of thing. I find fascinating long road trips and then long paddles and float plane drop offs and things like that. I'd like to experience that sense of just being completely detached from the world.
It's amazing, isn't it? You mentioned John Gearack there, and it's amazing. No matter how far away he is to us and how different the fishing is, certainly in the UK, how many people he has impacted here as well. And I know two of us, including, there's many more that feel a similar sort of way. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, I think he's got a very easygoing style, hasn't he? That's really appealing. And that whole kind of trout bum culture, isn't it? That kind of road trip, camp coffee kind of culture is, For the likes of us who are crammed onto a small island that has too many inhabitants, it's got a feeling of escapism to it, hasn't it, that we can only really aspire to.
Yeah,
maybe if we, you know, there are a few places, aren't there, in the Scottish Highlands, and one or two places not all that far from me in the northern Pennines that can feel like semi-wilderness at times. But yeah.
I've fished one of those, I think, and I just was blown away by it. I just thought it was a fabulous stream. I got bitten by midges and stuff like that, and the wind thankfully came up. But I thought, wow, this is just phenomenal. And we're you know, similar for us, we have Dartmoor, and it's just fantastic. You feel as though you're getting away a little bit, and finding a bit of water that you think nobody's been on for quite some time. And there's something really special about that, and really enjoyable. And I hope I'll be doing that real soon. If we do get this lockdown lifted, have you got a plan? Do you know what you're going to do? Do you know where you're going to go? Do you know how you're going to do it? Do you have something sort of locked away that's sort of keeping you going, really?
Yeah, I mean, so much of it depends on timing, doesn't it? We all start the season with big plans, don't we? And then as the clock's ticking now, one by one, they're kind of toppling like little dominoes at the moment, it feels. I've got a few things in the pipeline. There was going to be a lot of spring fishing on our local rivers after big hatch feeding trout. I've got a very kind invite from a friend of mine to go and fish the mayfly hatch on the Wiley, which is, that'll be completely alien to me. Chalk streams, I've barely touched a chalk stream. And I think if things go the way they look like they're going to go, I think I'm probably going to be heading up into the hills and maybe doing a bit of camping stroke fishing on, you know, some of the remoter waters I can find. I really don't know.
It's nice. It looks as though it's just nice having those little plans and being able to think about those a little bit when times aren't quite so easy. And I hope all those come off. Can you believe we've nearly been talking an hour and a half, and we've gone completely off on all sorts of weird and wonderful directions? But I think it's been wonderful to speak to you. I'm really proud that we've had somebody like yourself in the magazine as well. You deliver, and I know one of the things with Gearak that they say, he delivers an article in really good shape that needs nothing doing to it. And it's really cool with your stuff. It's been exactly the same, you know, that it's perfectly delivered and we can just load it up. And that's been absolutely fantastic. And I hope you'll continue your writing. I hope you'll continue to enjoy your fishing just as much as you always have done. There's little doubt in my mind that's not going to change anytime soon. And it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you, Matt, and learn a little bit about your fishing, about the things that mean so much to you. So really, thank you so much for chatting with me.
Thanks, Pete. It's been a pleasure. It's been all mine, believe me.
Fantastic. Well, I hope we'll get to spend some time on the river sometime, and I may come hunt you down on that river that I think we have just been talking about sometimes. So that would be wonderful. But thanks so much again for talking to me. So Matt, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for chatting with me. This is Pete Tigist. This has been the Fly Culture Podcast. Please keep well, please keep safe. And perhaps even by the time this is out, we may be fishing again soon. But thanks again for listening to everyone. I hope you've enjoyed this podcast as much as I have recording it. Thanks.
The Fly Culture Podcast is brought to you in association with Fly Culture, a quarterly print magazine. For more information, please visit flyculturemag.com. You can also find Fly Culture on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter.